Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Philip Beverly, Charlie Kirk, David Lundy, and Chris Roebling. Our program tonight coming to my home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago on State Street, that great street, and where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, it's brucedumont@museum.tv. And if you'd like to tweet us a comment, it's @DUMO. And tonight, for the next couple of hours, we're going to be talking about U.S. foreign policy. And we begin, obviously, the focal point is the news about the president's decision to launch airstrikes against ISIS targets in Iraq. And David Lundy, you are one of our card-carrying Democrats this evening. Your reaction to the president's military action?
I was very pleased that the president took this action. Frankly, I thought it was a little overdue. I tend to view ISIS like you would view a bully. And with bullies, you don't prick them on the arm and say and expect them to react well to it. I think the president needs to be amped up significantly more. I think he needs to get more aggressive on ISIS. And I think he needs to really deal these guys a body blow, because part of what's going on right now is they are terrorizing people with the perception that they are terrorizing people. They are creating this brand that you don't want to mess with us because we will destroy you and behead your children, et cetera. And I just think you can't take that lightly. And the idea, you know, candidly, I am a Democrat. I do defend the president. But when I heard that the first airstrike he took on was he dropped two bombs, I was flabbergasted.
Flabbergasted that it was so few.
Yes.
I want to turn to our other Democrat before we get Republican response. That's Philip Beverly from Chicago State University, longtime political science professor. Your reaction to the president's decision?
I thought it would have been a little bit harder. I have to agree with Dave. If you're going to go with the airstrike option, go heavy. Everything that moves that's related to ISIS needs to stop moving.
Is there any political price he can pay with Democrats for his action now, since he's not going to have to ever go to the polls again?
No, not really. I think most people recognize that ISIS is a scourge, and that they're going to have to be dealt with. And it's better, I think, to contain them in place than have their foreign fighters end up in Western cities.
Chris Roebling, one of our Republicans, your reaction?
Well, I'm delighted to hear from David and Philip, as I have. But I have to say that the president is too late and he's doing too little. And unfortunately, I agree with Philip. Most everybody understands ISIS to be the scourge that David has described and that I consider it to be. I'm sure Charlie joins me, except President Obama. And we've got in the, you know, very trenchant news analysis in the New York Times today that says the president has chosen a middle path in which he's not trying to extinguish ISIS. He's trying to push it back. He even said in this very big New York Times one-hour interview with Tom Friedman on Friday afternoon, a very unusual interview, but very insightful at this point, he said, you know, we've got to push them back. He didn't use the language of extinguishing them, obliterating them, and for him to talk about a new Middle East where there are no victors, no vanquished, that's not how ISIS plays.
Charlie Kirk from Turning Point USA joins us.
Right. So I find it really interesting. Just giving everyone a perspective, the listeners that might not know a lot about ISIS, the traditional al-Qaeda arm has disavowed ISIS as being too extreme. Just to give an idea of who we're dealing with here and what ISIS is, they have totally disowned. They said they're too extreme. They go too far. I mean, you look at the videos. ISIS will go into a village and just mow down hundreds of children. I would have to agree with almost everyone at this table. I think it's not a bold enough move. And Obama, really, he has a hall pass here where he could drop 300 bombs and not really pay a political price. Democrats and Republicans would applaud him. I don't know anybody who would oppose that kind of action, considering the existential threat that ISIS has to the entire region.
But how can you How can you focus where those attacks would be? Right at the moment, again, we're dealing with the people on the mountaintop, the humanitarian crisis on the mountaintop. Mm-hmm. We're dealing with the Kurds.
Just very quickly.
There's a lot of complexity here.
I'll yield.
Yeah, very, very quickly. You've got to protect this Erbil situation and that city and that encampment of Americans and Kurds and many other people from other countries.
Which is a successful city.
It's a tremendous, yeah, the Kurdistan area in what used to be northwest Iraq, which is now sort of kind of the Islamic State. We're using terms that no longer really apply in reality. Yeah. But the Mosul Dam is something of enormous significance to everything south of the Mosul Dam, which includes Mosul, as it happens, but more importantly, the single greatest concentration of Iraqis and indeed Baghdad. So if we've seen people like ISIS blow up statues because they want to eliminate the scourge of the statue and that religious symbology, if ISIS decides to wipe out tens of thousands of people at a time, they will blow up the Mosul Dam. So that dam, you asked,
but they're not in control of it at this moment.
No, they are,
They are in control of it.
How can you do that from 30,000 feet?
You have to coordinate with the Iraqi armed forces, such as they are, those who will not run away. So we are in an extremely difficult situation because of bad choices made along the way.
And here's the thing. I am frustrated because what this situation calls for is a new coalition. And it's a coalition where you bring in the Turks, who I know the Turks have their own Kurdish issues. I get that. But you bring in the Turks and you say, look, this is an existential threat to you because they're coming your direction next. You bring in your allies. You mobilize the Iraqi command and control. You arm the Kurds. You bring in NATO and you say, this is potentially an existential threat to all of us.
Right.
They're going to come to Europe. They're going to come to the United States. That one of the really disturbing things about ISIS is that they have recruited Americans and Brits and French and Germans.
Over 1,000 from all over the world.
Americans. All of whom have passports that they could use to get back into the country. I mean, this is not al-Qaeda. This is al-Qaeda on steroids,
right.
And it is terrifying. And
with $400 million.
And you were there when I said
where?
That.
From
industry of Mosul and other cities that
they captured the central bank in Mosul and they got $400 million.
So far more financially solid than al-Qaeda and more radical.
They are the most serious terrorist threat in human history. Yep. That's Senator McCain, because of the money, because of the land that they possess, because of the military. They've picked up American military hardware.
They're using our stuff.
Where the Iraqis have run away, and they're using our stuff again. Okay, et cetera. So,
why are Iraqis still running away from protecting their own country, Philip?
I don't think we spent enough time with them and gave them enough incentive. I think
to save their own country.
In their heart of hearts,
to save their own
children.
They
knew this was coming. And until you are willing to go to the end, and they're not willing to go to the end yet.
So they're not willing to die for their country,
no.
But the ISIS radicals are willing to die for
the
country.
Have more allegiance to their tribal bounds. To
right.
Yeah,
Iraq.
The country
exactly.
has excluded them under
right.
Maliki.
Right, exactly.
Right. Okay. So, okay. 1-800-723-8029. When we come back, your calls. 1-800-723-8029. Why don't you be the first to test our phone lines tonight? From Athens, Georgia to Austin, Texas, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Thank you very much for joining us coast to coast and border to border. Dave, you were going to make a point during the break.
Yeah, I think that this table, we're all in agreement. But the people who are not in agreement are the American people. They are still very war weary. They do not want us to be doing this. They do not want us to be bombing. They do not want us to go back into Iraq. You know, President Obama takes a lot of heat, and including from this table. And he takes a lot of heat because he basically followed the American people's desires to extricate ourselves fully. And right now, that's problematic.
I think Obama's leadership is perfectly legitimate subject for conversation. And we have to say the American people, as much as they're war weary, I don't disagree with you. And I'm not saying we should ought to send the 82nd Airborne. I'm not saying we should put troops in Iraq or Syria today. I'm not saying that. But the American people are about as univocal as you're going to see in disliking Obama's foreign policy. I mean, we're up at 60% plus.
Yeah, but
that is a and I think that that's interrelated with Obama's, as you point out, kind of followership. Obama sort of followed the American
people. If you're around the world, if you're an enemy of the United States, whether it is a state or whether it is in some some camp somewhere in Syria, you look at CNN, you look at Fox, you know that the American people are not supporting this type of activity. They don't want. They're afraid to make an American commitment. They don't want military action. They're saying even on the Republican side, one of the leading candidates is talking more like an isolationist, Rand Paul. They're reading these tea leaves in the power centers around the world. So why would they not keep going and doing things?
And this is why the president is really uniquely situated. He doesn't have. He can't run for re-election. He has the opportunity to do the right thing. And in being heavy-handed about it, I don't think anybody's going to criticize him for it. We will put troops on the ground, though.
When you say heavy-handed, does he have what it takes to be heavy-handed?
No.
The man got Osama bin Laden a bullet in the face. Okay. Are you kidding me?
It was a huge thing to violate a country's sovereignty to go get somebody because too much could have gone wrong with that.
Barack Obama has a history of misunderstanding what he is facing. He misunderstood Libya, and he has accepted responsibility for that, to his credit. He misunderstood.
What can we do now? I don't want to turn this into an Obama bashing show.
I've said this before.
I'd love that.
What I've said before on this program, and I say tonight, it starts with a vision, and that vision has to be clear.
And he has no vision.
Hillary Clinton said that. Well, I don't want to get into Hillary, but the vision that if Barack Obama it presents the world as it is his vision, then that's a world that includes the beheading of Christian children by ISIS. Now, he has somehow gotten himself into a position where no victors, no vanquished, leaving ISIS on the field. That's unacceptable.
How do we get ISIS now? Again, with the airstrikes, they no longer, or they certainly will be, they will change their MO, because in recent weeks they've been on the highways and byways. They have felt unfettered in what they wanted to do.
Freedom of movement.
They had that in open highways and fields. They have to be a little more concerned about that now because of the strikes that are coming their way. So it seems to me what they do is, like mice, they flee.
Yeah.
They go into areas. They hide in schools. They hide wherever they have to hide. I mean, certainly we know what's happening, in the Gaza. I mean, where enemies can hide, hiding behind women and children. And then we're going to see the pictures of dead women and children. We've already seen a lot of that, beheadings. What do we do next? How do we find them next? At 30,000 feet.
We're going to need to put troops on the ground. Now, that isn't conventional.
That's a Democrat who just said that.
That's not conventional forces. That's people in the special operations community whose job it is to hunt people down in the shadows and put a bullet in their brain pan.
They're there. Aren't they there already?
Do we have enough? Do we have enough? No.
From the president's affect when he was announcing this activity on Thursday afternoon in the White House, my sense is they're not. And you asked that question about how do our adversaries view all of this. Yeah. When they see the president hesitant about this very light involvement, I think that's very encouraging to them. I think the president needs to – you asked what is he – he's got to be forceful.
Yeah. And decide.
He's got to say – well, I'm not saying shock and awe. He's got to say this will not stand. This is contrary to the civilized world. And I'm going to build a coalition to wipe it out.
Speaking of coalition, let's go to Rand in Austin, Texas. He's got a question. Go ahead, Rand, listening to us on KLBJ. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just curious about why something's missing from this conversation. You're talking about putting a coalition together using, like, the Turks. And, I mean, why don't we go, you know, start at the head of this beast. Let's go to Saudi Arabia. They're the ones that are funding this whole stupid thing.
Right.
Let's go to them and say, hey, pull these guys back. Or, you know, we're going to drop a bomb in Riyadh, you know, and force them.
Rand is very...
They're armed to the teeth.
Right.
Let them go fight these guys.
They've
got enough. They've got more F-16s than we do. You know, let them go. Let them go fight them.
All right.
This is an extremely important geostrategic element of the current morass. There has been such a shift in, let's say, U.S. policy towards the Shias, okay, and that has been so complicating in the region that the Saudis and a variety of emirates in the Gulf of Arabia, or the Gulf of Persia, depending on how you say it, have been backing this Sunni, okay, this is a Sunni operation, ISIS, and they've been backing this so as to counterbalance Iran's support for various Shia activities, including the Alawites, which is where you get Bashar Assad. So this is kind of several steps down, but it's a Rand in Texas makes a very important point. We have to be dealing with our own allies like the Saudis and the Kuwaitis and the Emirates in the Gulf to get this support withdrawn from ISIS.
But isn't that part of the Obama strategy? No victors, no vanquished. Isn't that more acceptable to the Saudis? Right?
To be
in a position
Saudis
where
are after
their
five,
guys don't lose.
I don't think they even consider these people to be their guys. I think after 5.5 years, the Saudis have got a catalog of problems with Obama. And unfortunately, we're in the midst of trying to get Tehran to sit down and sign something. That is not what the Saudis want. And I think we got real problems.
David, and then another call.
But look, it is worth remembering that the Saudis, one of the reasons that the Saudis stepped up their funding of ISIL and ISIS is at the urging of John McCain and Lindsey Graham, who talked to Prince Bandar and told him the Obama administration won't fund the rebels. You need to do it. And they stepped up. They funded it. And after that funding is when ISIS all of a sudden started going exploding across the region. You just can't ignore that. These things have consequences.
David has this theory, which I don't think is...
I don't have a theory.
David, this is David's theory, and
it's
been well high regard for David. I disagree. I don't think that John McCain was saying fund ISIS. John McCain is the guy saying bomb the crap out
John
of ISIS
McCain
today.
John McCain said fund the Syrian rebels.
Has always been for funding the rebels.
Right.
Whoever the rebels are, wherever they are,
no, he didn't
he's
say
a rebel
all
guy.
Of them. But the whole
well,
point
know,
about 3 years ago
speaking,
was
that's part of his MO.
The whole part about getting in 3 years ago was while some rebels who were more acceptable to us were still alive. And those are the guys who got wiped out by ISIS. So I disagree with my friend David.
George in Downers Grove, listening to us on our flagship WLS. Good evening. You're on the air coast to coast. Well, hot. How about that? Chris, you're in Palatine. Not Palestine, Palatine. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, yes. I heard all this, you know, fuzzy noise. I wasn't sure what was going on. Anyway,
someone just hung up on me on the air.
Oh, how would somebody?
I'm going to check the NSA tapes tonight. We're going to find out where that guy is.
Absolutely.
We're going to have a drone strike in his house tomorrow. Go ahead.
Look out! I hope I don't live near him. Anyway, I think we should, through various channels, give the green light to the Iranians to go in and send in volunteers to defend their Shiite brothers against these Sunni butchers that are out there. Because this is basically a Sunni Shiite war that's been going on for 1,400 years, and the Sunnis are being, these ISIS people are being supported by Saudi Arabia. We should let the Iranians in there, to let them loose, and let them take care of these butchers.
Okay. Let me get everybody's response. Philip Beverly, what do you think of that idea?
It's never going to happen. We've done the Iran-Iraq War in 1979. Bad for the region.
Chris, any comment on that?
Yeah, I mean, Iraq is on life support. What we have called Iraq for the last 95 years, it's not really there, and we're inches. I mean, we're right in the precipice. So we're not going to get. We need Iraq to get self-aware relative to inclusion in the government, but we cannot even wait for that to wipe out ISIL.
But this battle that we're dealing with, this ISIS now, I mean, they've erased all the borders.
That's right.
I mean, they don't care. This is not about borders. This is not about sovereignty of a country. This is about their ideology.
About a caliphate.
And they want to keep marching. They'll march wherever they can go, Charlie.
Well, it's about a caliphate, and they have a theological motive more than anything else that is religious in its base. I'm not making an indictment of Islam. I'm saying if you look at their statements and you look at why they're doing what they're doing, they're fighting more for an ideology that has a theological backing of jihad. And so because of that, the way that I agree with my counterparts here is the only way to deter that is to create an international coalition of people that would not necessarily agree with each other, because this is an existential threat to Israel, Iran, the entire region, and America at large.
When we come back, we're going to take more calls, and also I'm going to share with you a piece that ran this morning on ABC. Martha Raddatz had a wonderful piece on her broadcast. We're going to share that with you and then talk about it. 1-800-723-8289 from coast to coast and border to border live every Sunday night. I'm Bruce Dumont. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. We have four great guests around the table, America's only real political roundtable. And we begin with David Lundy, who will now introduce himself briefly.
I am president of a PR and public affairs agency called Aileron. We work with clean energy, technology, pharma companies. I have a wife and two children, Eli and Max, who I will say hi to.
So they stay up late and watch the television show.
Well, they're at least listening on radio.
Or at least they TiVo it. Charlie Kirk.
I'm the founder and executive director of Turning Point USA, national student movement educating for free markets, limited government. You can follow me on Twitter at CharlieKirk11.
And you're on television all the time. You're on the networks, and then you sort of come here and you slum it with us every Sunday night. Periodically.
I'm going to say hi to my dog, Winston. So,
Philip Beverly, the always controversial Philip Beverly.
Always controversial. I'm a political science professor down at Chicago State University. Have been next coming up Friday, 23 years.
Wow. Very good. And Chris Roebling.
Good evening. I'm a longtime friend of the program, and I operate a public relations and public affairs firm called Clearspan Strategic here in Chicago.
Mike in St. Joseph, Michigan, listening to us on WLS Radio. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I was a member of the 101st Airborne Division back in 79 when Carter was president. And we sat in Fort Hood, Texas, the 101st Airborne, the 82nd Airborne, for 40 days waiting for a decision made by Carter to go in and get the hostages out. And we didn't do anything but send 9 helicopters in. It was a pinprick and it was a disaster. But anyway, I've got 3 nephews in the military right now and 2 very close friends with their sons in the military.
What do you want done, Mike?
That we have right, pardon?
What do you want done?
I want a commander-in-chief that stands up and is a commander-in-chief. I want him to lay out what it is that these poor men and women in our military are supposed to do and are willing to do, instead of just say, you know what? Let's tell the enemy that we're going to send a couple pinpricks in, but you know what? We're not going to do anything other than
but
that.
But let me ask... let me ask you this question from a practical standpoint, because you've served your country and we appreciate that service. And you're going to have to wait at least another couple of years if you want to select the next commander-in-chief, because this one we've got for the next couple of years, and I don't think there's going to be impeachment. That's a different discussion. But he's you may not like him, but he's the president we have at the moment. My question to you, from a strategic point of view, as being a military guy, how do you go in and track down people who are hiding in villages? They're threatening, they're terrorizing everyone that they run into. They're picking up support from not only all over the region, but they're picking up support from around the world. Over 1,000 fighters from all over the world. Anyone that hates the United States, basically, they're making their way to join ISIS so they can fight the United States and our interests wherever they are. And at this particular moment, how do you track them down? I mean, can you do it from 30,000 feet? That's my big question.
Well, you don't need to be 30,000 feet because you can put drones up there to isolate them. And then you can have the drones visually with laser target, and you can have a strike. I think the thing that gets me the most is when I was listening to the president the other day, he made it clear that there is no military solution to this problem.
And I'd like to pick up from Mike.
I'd like to pick up.
Mike is making, and I join Bruce in thanking you for your service. Mike's making a very important point, and that is that we have technology today, and I'm well aware of the strengths and the limitations of air power and what we've seen, you know, since air power was introduced into the, you know, field of combat. But today we have a mix of capabilities between satellites, between drones, with laser guided, with smart technology, and also with aircraft, okay, piloted aircraft. There is a lot we can do. David said 10 minutes ago, command and control is basically in eastern Syria. I mean, and I think we can be pretty sure that the NSA and the CIA and the Israeli Defense Forces all know within about a half a mile where it is. And so ISIL could be decapitated.
That's right.
ISIL could be decapitated in the midst of what is going on now. I hope that President Obama has started with what he has started so that he can get to decapitating ISIL in a couple of weeks. I hope that at some level, and I don't mean to
think he would not. Let's speculate why he would not do that. Philip,
there's something about Syria that do you send the wrong signal when you now attack the rebels, because that has been this sort of group that's been really undefined, the rebels in the Syrian civil war. Mm-hmm. And now it seems that you're backing the guy that you've made out to be this villain in Assad. And maybe he just doesn't want to have to explain all of that.
I don't think he's comfortable with making difficult foreign policy choices. I mean, there's circumstance after circumstance that I can point to. I just don't think maybe it's something inside of him. Maybe it's the people around him. Maybe it's just who he is. But he's not comfortable, whether it's Putin, whether it's Syria, he's not comfortable making a choice where there might be repercussions.
I want to bring into this discussion, Hillary Clinton was interviewed in The Atlantic monthly. And The Atlantic, and she was talking about President Obama. And this is what she had to say. The failure to help build up a credible fighting force of the people who were the originators of the protests against Assad, there were Islamists, there were secularists, there was everything in the middle. The failure left a big vacuum which the jihadists have now filled.
You see, this is why Hillary will not be elected president. That's another conversation. But I also want to say she's pretty correct, and this fits in with what McCain was saying.
Right.
But I'm trying to get to what are we going to do now? What are we going to do now? And what we've got to do now is decapitate ISIL, and we've got to send a statement to the world that we are devoted to this policy, and that means you can devote yourself to this policy, because if we waver, I mean, you're quoting the Hillary Clinton Atlantic interview. Right. I want to quote the President Obama Tom Friedman interview. He said, and Putin, well, you know, Putin could invade. He could invade. It is inconceivable to me that an American president with the issues that are currently pending would get himself into the position of saying, well, yeah, Putin could invade. Yeah. I mean, that is that's area where nobody would ever go.
I'm sorry, Chris, you've confused me. You're saying the president shouldn't acknowledge reality?
I think that the president has to say there is a price to be paid for taking Crimea. There is a price to be paid for arming rebels. There is a price to be paid.
I believe he said that quite clearly.
It wasn't in the Friedman interview. It's not in the Friedman interview.
Sorry,
it's not part of the policy.
Sanctions. He mobilized the Europeans after the downing of the civilian aircraft. I mean, look, I will criticize President Obama For what I believe is a failure to take bold enough action right now. And I agree with those who are striking that critique. But for what it's worth, I've heard an awful lot of analysts who don't agree with what Hillary Clinton is saying in this speech and saying, look, it's just not that simple to arm these rebels and that would have created an alternative. Including Ambassador Chris Hill, who said that this morning. It's just not that
Charlie.
Simple.
Yeah, I want to add another part to this. I think that another vacuum that was created by, I think, political theater, and that was the rapid de-escalation of U.S. involvement in post-Iraq conflict. We totally evacuated Iraq, didn't have any sort of base or presence. I think Barack Obama did that for political purposes. He wanted to say that he ended the war in Iraq. It sounded really good. He had the shots of him in Kuwait, you know, high-fiving the last soldier to leave. Mm-hmm. But what that did is it said, hey, whoever wants it, it's up for grabs. And we could have held a base there with 10,000 soldiers. I think that would have put a different message worldwide.
Frank, listening to us on XM POTUS radio, go ahead, from Columbus, Ohio. Go ahead, Frank.
Hi. It just seems like the same not very smart people got us in Iraq, want to get us back from Iraq. They wanted to get us in Syria and arm the people right now who are destroying Iraq. It just seems like there's a lot of politicians, such as people on your panel, they're always willing to throw out our lives to heck to protect people that won't even protect themselves. And it just makes me, and a lot of former military
Frank,
you don't value our lives.
Yeah, Frank, that's exactly wrong. That's 180 degrees, and here's why. Let me just tell you why that's wrong. It is wrong because the Director of National Intelligence, the Secretary of Homeland Security, and the Director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation each this week told Congress that ISIL represents a direct threat to the United States itself. Okay, so we are not going, using our air power, using our technology, using the variegated means we have to paint up the command and control and decapitate ISIL. That is not something we're doing for Bashar Assad. It's not something we're doing for Nouri al-Maliki. It is something we are doing to protect our countrymen, our friends, neighbors, and family. That is a U.S. defense mandate. That is an interest of the United States.
Charlotte in Arlington Heights, Illinois, listening to us on WLS. Go ahead. Are you there, Charlotte? Charlotte
said Obama should come home from Martha's Vineyard. That's what she was going to say. That's really what she said.
Line three is a problem.
We have line three. Let's report that line three is a problem. We have deduced that line three is a problem, and we know that.
We know that
Todd Neble will be on that like a tee on a bull. 1-800-723-8289. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much. I referenced a few moments ago that today on this week, Martha Raddatz was sitting in for George Stephanopoulos, and she did a background piece, actually a roll-in piece, about what was happening involving ISIS. And it included some footage from an independent news source called Vice, which you may be hearing about. And I'm going to play that for you. For those listening and watching the program on television, you will see it visually. But again, I think the power of what is said is also important, so it will be referenced also for those listening to us on radio, and I will do some translation for some of the things that are listed as a television show, on screen. So let's roll that tape. Martha Raddatz.
Islamic militant group ISIS in Syria and Iraq is so extreme that traditional al-Qaeda has disavowed it. And now, from Vice News, video from inside the militant stronghold. Surreal scenes from the Syrian city of Raqqa. Families enjoying the coolness of the Euphrates. But even here, there is always something more sinister, even with the children.
In the name of God, my name is Daoud, and I am 14 years old. I like to join the Islamic State in Iraq to kill with them.
And what happens in Syria affects Iraq, and vice versa. The treasures from the March on Baghdad are proudly paraded through Raqqa, along with new recruits from around the world.
I say to America, don't be cowards and attack us with drones. Instead, send your soldiers, the ones we humiliated in Iraq. We will humiliate them everywhere, God willing. And we will raise the flag of Allah in the White House.
Here, the group is known simply as IS, or Islamic State. At a nighttime gathering, recruiting continues. Beautiful virgins are calling. Enroll me as a martyr, this man sings.
In life, in that part of the world at this moment in history, is there any real reason or is there any real ability for a young man not to get wrapped up into the fight that is being portrayed to him, especially when if he doesn't join, he may be killed? Philip?
We've seen it in other places in the world with especially boy soldiers in parts of Africa that if there's no other alternatives, they're going to end up there. I don't want us to become too enamored, one, with technology, because technology is not going to solve our problems. Right. We've learned that in the intelligence business, this idea that we've got satellites and we've got this. We still need people on the ground.
Let's go to Bob driving in Michigan, listening to us on Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Go ahead, Bob.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm listening to the discussion, and a couple of things stand out to me that are missing from the conversation. The first is that you have people talking about what President Obama should or shouldn't be doing at the moment to coalesce, a group of people into a form of action that's just completely inconsistent with what's happening in the entire region right now. We backed regimes for 50, 60-plus years for the flow of oil to continue, and I'm not saying that that was wrong. It was necessary for the Western world. Having said that, many of those leaders have fallen by the wayside, and you're looking for leadership in a region that is completely fraught with religious ideology, driving every young man in the area who doesn't have a job, who has no ability mm-hmm. to provide for himself or a future wife, and the only thing that's left is militism. And it's very difficult to devise a cohesive strategy that people are going to follow from thousands of miles away with an established republic of over 200 years as though we can somehow get these people to do our bidding. I mean, it's ridiculous to say that. And the last thing I'll say before I sign off and listen is that President Obama did not have the ability to leave 10,000 troops in Iraq. We had transferred authority to a sovereign nation, watched it on TV, and we asked them to allow our military, if they were going to remain and have presence, to have immunity from any repercussions in the event that there were firefights or deaths that came from further action. And they said no. So the Iraqi government denied our ability to stay within that country. So how people can now blame Obama for us not having a military presence there is just simply misleading.
Okay, Chris, stay on the line, Bob. We'll let Chris respond.
Yeah, Bob is reading from the talking points, and I want to tell you, the Obama administration has to take responsibility sometime for something, or else his elections are nullities. Okay, and the Bobs of the world want to say it's great to elect Obama, but we're not going to hold him accountable for any of his diplomatic successes
but
or Christy, failures.
But I'm going to interrupt you for a moment. The point that Bob was making is, and this is the great frustration of a lot of American people who are tired of spending 4,400 lives lost.
As I am.
Okay.
As I am.
All right. So they're saying, wait a minute. We fought for a country. We turned over the country because we thought there were enough people in that country that cared about their country. And that's my point. Where are the people who care about their country?
I think
where are they?
I think that the Obama...
And if there's a battle within the differences of opinions, let them fight that. Let there be a civil war and let there be a winner to it.
Yeah. That, on the Iraq issue, Iraq was handed to the Obama administration to build on what we had achieved. On the ISIL issue, we have got to eliminate ISIL now because, as Anthony Cordesman says in the New York Times, the Islamic State is growing too strong, and it is growing too strong too quickly.
And on that note, I will tell you, if you're listening to this program on television, we will see you next week, or you will see us next week, hopefully. And if you're listening to us on radio, we're going to be back for another full hour. We have a lot of calls on the line. We will hear from them and hear from them and continue our conversation. We'll also talk about what's happening with Israel and the Palestinians. Back shortly. From Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with hour number two of Beyond the Beltway. Tonight featuring commentary by Philip Beverly of Chicago State University, Charlie Kirk, the founder of Turning Point USA, David Lundy, a Democratic consultant and president of Aileron Communications, and Chris Roebling, Republican consultant with ClearScan Strategic LLC. Our program tonight coming to you from the Museum of Broadcast Communications. You've got a tough... I gotta work on your
clear span.
Clear span. Okay.
Span.
Okay. It's gonna be tough. Anyway. Our phone line's open, 1-800-723-8029. 1-800-723-8029. We're going to continue our discussion. Also I want to talk about what's happening with Israel and the Palestinians and Hamas.
Same thing. We mean nor Hamas, less Hamas.
I don't like Hamas or hummus. I don't like either. My question is this. We're going to talk about a serious issue. But I have to stop laughing first.
Okay.
We did get a call in the last hour. She did not get on the air, but briefly we saw it on the screen that it was about the vacation, the president going on vacation. Presidents always go on vacation. They always go on vacation in August. And whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, I think presidents need vacations. And every single year, there tends to be something that happens when they're on vacation. And there's criticism from the opposing party challenging why on earth did they go on vacation? Why don't they come back and be at the White House so they can be in charge? And I want to just take a quick – I don't want to spend a lot of time on it because I don't think it warrants it, but just quick reaction from David.
Barack Obama has taken fewer vacation days than any recent president by far, by orders of magnitude. George W. Bush took enormous criticism in August of 2005 when he was on vacation as Iraq was falling apart. Also in 2005 was Hurricane Katrina, and George W. Bush was still on vacation during Hurricane Katrina.
So should they go on vacation or not? That's my question.
Presidents need vacations. Look, we need vacations. I've got one coming up this week. I am so excited. My brain desperately needs it. Maine and Campobello Island, Canada.
Oh, wonderful. Kenny Bunkport, Lobster.
I think it's the optics that people are worried about. If they're on vacation, they must not be doing their job. And the job of the president is 24/7, 365.
Right.
The White House is wherever he is. The man makes decisions. They get done. They don't need to be done in D.C.
Charlie?
Yeah, well, I mean, you're right. He's taken less vacations, but he's also played more rounds of golf in D.C. And I would argue that, I mean, his whole administration's kind of almost like a vacation because he really doesn't ever govern or lead. But, I mean, that's besides the point. But, I mean, he's here. He's Martha's Vineyard, and he orders an airstrike of two bombs, and he finishes the back nine. I mean, that's no different than a day in D.C. for him.
So. I don't begrudge him or anybody else a vacation, Congress or president or governor or whatever. But I think his vacation narrative, his fundraiser narrative, his, you know, do something in D.C. and then hop on a plane and fly across the country to a fundraiser with, you know, liberals in San Francisco or whatever. I think it adds to the perception that he is relatively disengaged. And I think that's what you're beginning to see in the approval ratings. I mean, it's not the dispositive factor. I mean, what's dispositive about the Obama administration is the lack of results.
Do you think there's a way for him to turn the polls around, David? Turn them around significantly enough to affect positively Democrats running for House and Senate this year?
Well, I don't think he's going to make a meaningful change in his poll numbers between now and November. I'm not sure yet how impactful his poll numbers are going to be on Democrats nationally. This is a weird election. There is no wave. There is no common theme here. People have said it's kind of like the Jerry Seinfeld show of elections. It's an election about nothing.
It really is.
And so I don't think that's the case. I just want to take one point, though, on the poll numbers, because Chris earlier talked about the 60% disapproval of Obama's foreign policy, and clearly the numbers are high. I think that, though, frankly, reflects more about the fact that right now, you know, the world is going to hell in a handbasket. You've got so many situations going on all over the world. So, are people upset about the president and his foreign policy, or are they just upset that we're going to hell in a handbasket? I can't say that there's a distinction.
You've been very critical in the first hour, Republicans, of the Obama administration strategy and how mistakes were made and who was responsible. And he's the big bad boogeyman. My question, as you look forward for the next 2 years, of defining what the Republican Party is and who is going to lead that party and what their strategy and what their new idea is going to be. Is this a time to really test the political potency of a semi, if not overt, isolationist policy that Rand Paul is espousing?
I think it definitely resonates with a lot of the American people, as we talked earlier. You know, Americans are still war-torn and battle-torn in more ways than one. But I will say this, the Republican Party has an opportunity to paint something that the Democrats have not, as far as Obama, and that is leadership and vision and decisiveness. And the Republicans have a plethora of governors that have exhibited leadership and people in power that have.
But my question, when it comes right down to foreign policy, I mean, isn't one of the major discussions of that Republican primary?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's going to be Rand Paul on one side, and whether
Santorum
it is Rick Perry or someone else on the other side.
I think,
God forbid, it's not Rick Santorum, but it is someone of a completely different stature, and the debate about the future of the Republican Party really is about the debate of the future of the country.
Well,
because the Democrats, at least what we know from Hillary Clinton, she may be the internationalist that's running, and Rand Paul, if he gets the Republican nomination, and the split is going to be between those two.
Well,
but
there's going to be
a year of debate within the Republican Party who they want to give that nomination to.
And I think it's already been noted that there are a lot of neocons from the Bush administration who are now who are being well received by Hillary's people because she is the internationalist and she does want to hold up the banner of democracy. And if the world is more democratic, then there will be fewer of these regional flare-ups. I think with respect to the Republican Party, Rand Paul is doing a lot to excite young people to a message of limited government and specified powers and efficiency and effectiveness in government executing those limited specified duties. I think that his brand of relatively less international involvement remains to be tested in the primaries that you describe. It could be Mitt Romney on the other side of that discussion, because Mitt Romney is making more noises about possibly running, or maybe not him, but people around him.
No.
And I think that the Republican Party remains internationalist, which is not to say interventionist. And it has to be more specific about things it would do both domestically and internationally.
But from a political standpoint, when you're counting the votes, Rand Paul is the guy at the moment. He'll pick a fight with Ted Cruz. He'll pick
yes.
a fight with, you know, he doesn't genuflect when John McCain walks into the room or Dick Cheney walks into the room
Neither does Ted Cruz. Ted Cruz is
closer to Rand Paul.
Ted Cruz is pretty, I don't mean to say it in a bad way. Cruz is writing his own story. He's not trying to import something.
What I'm saying is that Rand Paul, part of his appeal, and part of it is because of the youthful appeal, he's not afraid to stand up to the old guard of the party.
And what he's going to say,
a lot of young people like that.
What he'll say, and this will resonate with a lot of Tea Party conservatives, should we be sending money to Hamas? Should we be sending money to these countries? And that's going to be his
message.
Or should
we be sending money to Israel, which he's now
he decided to change his mind on. You're right, exactly.
We've got to pause. 800-723-8289. Back shortly from Chicago.
with that name cast.
Come on, thank you very much for joining us. 1-800-723-8029. We're not going to delve into a lot of 2016 politics,
thank
but again,
goodness.
During this break, we had some very revealing things said, and we're going to put them on the table, and then we're going to go back to calls. Charlie,
yes.
Tell everybody what you said.
I have a prediction to make on air, and this, I'm not necessarily supporting his candidacy.
Go ahead.
But I believe that Chris Christie will be the nominee for the Republican Party, and I'll substantiate it with three main points, the first of which, the Tea Party conservatives are going to commit suicide amongst themselves with a Ted Cruz, Rand Paul, Rick Santorum firing squad, which Chris Christie can walk over the bodies and pick up enough votes. Chris Christie's the head of the RGA, and he's meeting every single Republican donor nationwide, and he'll be able to get every contact that he needs to raise the money. And the third and final is which, he can bridge the gap between the people that like hard rhetoric and results and the people in the establishment that want to cut deals. Chris Christie can do it, and he'll be the nominee.
And
okay.
If you believe that, I've got a bridge to sell you in Fort Lee, my friend.
But we're going to save that tape. Chris Roebling, you also said something.
My statement is
shocking.
Hillary is not going to be the next president of the United States. And I've said this before on the program, but I'm
But you said something else.
She will not be the nominee.
Well, now, okay.
She will not
Whoa.
Be the nominee.
Yeah. That's a
and
new
I
one.
And I am saying it, and I'm going to stick with it.
And that'll be Hillary on the same tape.
She is going to fold. She is too brittle. She's got too many prior inconsistencies.
Okay.
Hillary can't do it.
Now, we have demonstrated that the Republicans have shown some intestinal fortitude.
Big time.
And big time. They've shown a pair here. I now want to turn to our Democrats, and I challenge you. It doesn't have to. I want you to say something equally bold and challenging about politics in 2013. Philip Beverly.
13?
I'm sorry, 16.
16.
So in 2016, the Democratic nominee will not be anybody that us sitting around the table have even mentioned.
Really?
There you go.
That's
I
bold.
See.
He's
with
That's
me.
That's bold. Okay.
He's with
All right, now let's see if the boldness of our other three panelists can be matched by our card-carrying Democrat.
First of all, I've lost my card. But anyway, I will say this, and to listeners of this program, they have heard the host of this program, the beloved host of this program, suggest that Rand Paul is the next great coming of the Republican Party. And I have said on this program, and I will maintain on this program, that Rand Paul will not be the nominee of the Republican Party in 2016.
Okay. I don't know
and
that's
I will match
bold.
Charlie Kirk's.
That. That's not that bold.
That's not bold? I will match Charlie
By
Kirk's.
By the way, because you mentioned my name.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
It's your show.
I want to be clear. What I've said is I believe that when the two final combatants for the Republican nomination are before the convention in Cleveland, Rand Paul will be one of those two people.
It won't go to the floor.
I will make another prediction.
Go ahead.
Jeb Bush will not make it through Republican primaries because of his stance on Common Core.
Yeah,
because of that, Jeb Bush is going to get his himself handed to him,
especially in Iowa, New Hampshire,
and he will not. Be it, which will leave you, by the way, since I also don't believe Charlie on the Christie argument. I believe you will have a Republican nominee that has the more conservative, the extreme conservative, and Rand Paul. You will not have a moderate in the Republican primary making it.
By
the
way,
convention.
One other name that I want to just throw out there, and that is Rick Perry.
Ugh. Yeah,
I'm seeing that Rick Perry has the potential.
Yeah.
To be the other guy with Rand Paul.
I agree.
I got three reasons why I like him.
Okay. Oh, that was my line.
I can't remember the third one though. I just
I think Perry is gonna. Yes. I think Perry and I think Mitt Romney. I think there are a lot of guys who are going to go out there a second time. I have heard Democrats praising, believe it or not, Rick Santorum. They finally started to put together
what
he's... No. I'm serious.
No, I'm serious.
I'm serious.
For what?
The fact that he is sincerely concerned about the plight of the American middle class, that he is talking about blue-collar jobs, that he's talking about opportunity for something above minimum wage, and he is doing so in a way that is not offensive necessarily to private union membership or to American manufacturing. I mean, that he is really tapped into something
there.
He's
a great Pennsylvanian politician who had to deal with unions his entire life, and he dealt with coal miners and those kind of Democrats.
And he got his lunch handed to him when he ran for re-election.
Well, yes, he did.
won't go too far. But my question about style. We've heard from Democrats and Republicans tonight that part of the style is the lack of bravado on the part of the president. The president is too removed and reserved. And I'm wondering, just stylistically, are the American people, are they looking for, you know, the tough-talking guy, whether it's the tough-talking Texan like George Bush or whether it's the Californian like Ronald Reagan? Are they looking for someone that's going to give them a little red meat, a little that someone around the world would be a little fearful of?
I think
that might be Christie.
I think that sometimes we underestimate the American people. I think they just want somebody who will give them results on what they say they're going to do.
I agree.
Whether they're a Democrat or a Republican. If you say you're going to do something to fix the economy, show me the results in that.
Yeah,
that's what I think they're looking for.
I mean, Barack Obama said what he wanted to do, and he is criticized by those on the left because he hasn't done it fast enough. Guantanamo isn't closed yet. He's sending in airstrikes and drones. He's deported more people than Bush. He's had more drone strikes than anybody else. So, I mean, these were the things. He didn't win the Democratic nomination by talking that way, but he's acting differently. I think what happens is, and I think it's whether it's a Republican or Democrat, maybe more with Democrats, it's so easy to run for president of the United States because you can flap your lip and you can say anything you want. And then you get in there and you get into the intelligence briefings and you look at what's really there. And I think with Barack Obama, when he got there and he looked around, he said, you know what? George Bush and Dick Cheney really weren't that bad. They really weren't that bad.
Well, certainly the actual physical policies of this administration are far closer to Cheney and Bush than anything he let on during the campaign.
Absolutely.
But my point about I want to pick up on, maybe you should cheer that. I do. I've frequently recognized that. But I want to say to Philip, I agree with you about the results, and I think that is why there is a bias towards governors, and there is going to be a bias in the 2016, which I generally don't like talking about because we got a lot going on in the November election, but there's going to be a bias to checking the record of economic development in the states where the governors have served.
Texas, big winner.
Texas is a winner. Indiana, not that we're going to get Mitch Daniels, but, you know, New Jersey. You're talking about Chris Christie, people will look at New Jersey. You talk about, you know, a Democrat governor, people will look at that state. People want to see an expanding economy, more jobs, greater opportunity, and rising incomes.
John in South Bend, Indiana, listening to us tonight. Go ahead. You're on the air listening to us on a federated radio station. Go ahead.
Yeah, the 95.3 out there in Elkhart.
You got it. Our good friend John Zimney. Go ahead.
Hey, it's other than everything out here, isolationism just... the attacks that we had under Clinton and culminating in September 11th. But when it comes down to this Iraq thing, we're trying to fix a broken paradigm. This was a creation of the British. Let's bust it all up, turn them into their little tribal warlords, their little regional areas, arm the ones we want, disarm the ones we don't, set them up, let them chew each other up, save the good guys. And go from there. And just as another aside...
And when the bad guys are all in the same place, bomb the hell out of them.
Get them. And here's a little thing that they may not realize. There's this thing over there called oil and petrochemicals. They could have more jobs. They could be bigger than Saudi Arabia if they'd stop screwing off.
David.
I think that... reading through what John was just saying, you know, we go back to the Biden plan for Iraq, which was widely mocked, back in 2005, I believe it was.
Break it up.
Joe Biden said, let's break up reasonably. The only way we can have peace over there is to have three federated states that are loosely federated, a Sunni area, a Shia area, and a Kurdish area. And that was his solution. And Joe Biden was mocked by the Bush people, by Dick Cheney, who said, no, we are going to have a unified Iraq, and this is going to be a success. And they was determined. And Joe Biden may just have been right.
And John may have been the first person to acknowledge that.
Yes.
And you're the second guy.
Yes.
And I'm the third. What the Republicans say.
No, I mean,
looking at where we are now, is that a solution here?
Well, the solution here right now, what I've been saying on this program is the problem is our intelligence services are telling us we're facing a direct threat from ISIL. It is more important that we eliminate that threat than it is that we sit around like the guys at the Versailles Conference in 1919 trying to come up with the next Iraq. Iraq has got its own issues, et cetera. We have to focus on ISIL, and we have to eliminate ISIL.
But by creating those nations and by letting, you know, let's the Palestinian issue as well. Give people some land that they want.
It is not. Let me tell you something. I understand.
It's not simple.
There is a lot of appeal to the simple solution, which is what Joe found his way to. God bless him. That is not always the right solution. And you cannot say we're going to take every Kurd and have him move out of the Sunni area. We're going to have every Shia and have him move out of the Sunni area.
It's already happening.
No.
It's already happening,
that
Chris.
That is what we are facing right now.
We've got to pause. 1-800-723-8029. 1-800-723-8029. I'm Bruce Dumont, live from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. Philip Beverly is here. He is a college professor of political science at Chicago State University. Charlie Kirk is the founder of Turning Point USA, which is organizing young people to support capitalism all over the United States, and a growing figure on the national media scene. David Lundy joins us. He's a Democratic consultant, president of Aileron Communications. And Chris Roebling, Republican consultant, is here, and he is with Clear Scan Strategic LLC. Clear Span Strategic. Well, I had it
all down. Right. Clear Span is a style of design, and it refers to no internal columnar supports, which only means it's open and it's
which
transparent.
Which is extremely appropriate for your political
wonderful
arguments,
but it's
that have
not,
no internal supports
but it's,
whatsoever.
But it's not an architectural
form. They're exoskeletal.
Also, we're going to get back to calls in just a moment. But again, you were making a point during the break that this past week we've been celebrating and commemorating the 40th anniversary of Richard Nixon's resignation has brought up a lot of Watergate discussion again.
Right.
And you wanted to make a point
about
Watergate.
Well, today, I think it was on Bob Schieffer's CBS Face the Nation.
Face the Nation. Yeah.
Carl Bernstein and Bob Woodward of Wheaton, Illinois fame sat together to chat about Watergate. And I commend it to everybody's attention. They have consistently, however, gotten a key point incorrect. I think the historic record, and this is now very well established, about the fateful meeting between Richard Nixon, Hugh Scott, John Rhodes, and Barry Goldwater was not an unanticipated conversation. That Richard Nixon himself personally said to the chief of staff at that point, who I think was Al Haig, I want them to come over. I want them to come over publicly. I want them to be interviewed on their way out. And Haig said, why? And Nixon, who knew at that time, this is 3 or 4 days before he knew he was resigning. They had already determined the day, the date, the time. They had already talked to Ford. He said, I do not want any of my successors to be saddled with a resignation by me that does not include a congressional act that is not clear for the entire public and the world to see. In other words, Nixon choreographed the meeting with Scott, Rhodes, and Goldwater to indicate that he was yielding to a congressional reality. It's a very important point, and it's established in all of the communication between Nixon and Haig. Now, what these guys said today on the phone, on the TV, which is incorrect, is he didn't know what Goldwater was going to say. He had already decided to resign. The whole thing was a setup so that people would see he was dealing with the reality of melted congressional support. He did not have support to continue in office, and therefore he was going to resign.
And it was a time when Republicans could stand up and publicly criticize a Republican president,
right,
and demand that he step aside because the votes were not there, unlike what happened
with Bill Clinton.
With Bill Clinton.
Right.
And there were no Democrats that had
right.
that.
Because, of course, the crimes committed by Richard Nixon were actual crimes that involved multiple agencies
perjury?
Of the United States government.
Perjury.
That involved
obstruction of justice, perjury, yeah. Surrendering your ticket.
That was not right. – there was no
so
obstruction of justice.
Of
I don't even know what surrendering your ticket is. That at the laundry with Monica's dress? What are you talking about?
No, he gave up his law license because of his transgressions against the law.
Sure. There were actual crimes and there was bogus right-wing
craziness. David.
Yes.
This is where David loses credibility.
My point is that at another point – when the presidency was tarnished, and I don't think you would disagree that the presidency of Bill Clinton was tarnished at that particular point. There had been an impeachment. It might have been political, but there had been an impeachment. What I'm saying is that there were no Democrats that stood up like Hugh Scott, like Barry Goldwater,
Rhodes.
And John Rhodes. There were no similar number of Democrats who had the gonads to go public and say what needed to be said about Bill Clinton.
Well,
and
let me
now
add to
you're
that.
You're reinventing history, Bruce, because there were many Democrats who were criticizing the president.
No, nobody in the Senate.
Name there
three.
Were many
you,
Democrats
you
at
had
the time
three.
Who were criticizing the president's conduct,
name
but
three.
Thought impeachment was an overreaction,
name three.
Which it was.
Yeah.
Name
there,
three.
There were no Senate Democrats.
Name three.
I don't remember who they were. I remember at the time. I'm sorry. It was 15 years ago.
Theirs was 40
I'm
years ago.
I'm talking about John Rhodes. I mean, as a little kid, I was watching John Rhodes and Barry Goldwater and Hugh Scott, and I thought, this is amazing. My God, they've got the head of the Republicans in the Senate, the head in the House, and Barry Goldwater, kind of the godfather of the party. But one other point. Bruce is absolutely right. Republicans on the House Judiciary Committee, Tom Railsback of Illinois himself personally voted for impeachment.
Right.
You remember that? And we had a Virginia member of the House
right.
who voted for impeachment who died only 10 days
Republican,
ago.
North Shore Republican.
We had Robert McClory. Robert McClory.
Crimes was caught on tape, erased evidence.
I guess lying under oath isn't a serious crime.
Lying
under oath, no big deal. No, that's not serious.
It was not a crime.
Dave. The question I asked was about who were the leading Democrats who stepped forward, and you might have said it wasn't the same crime. I'm talking about the embarrassment of the White House, and different parties reacted different ways. Okay, when things hit the fan, the Republicans can speak up and speak against their party. When the hit hits the fan with Democrats, they tend to circle the wagons
right.
much more so, and some would say to their credit because it shows discipline, but in much more so.
Wait, so let me
in
understand.
A much greater
the,
way.
The Democrats are the disciplined party, and the Republicans are the undisciplined party.
Are you kidding me?
Well,
it remains to this day you can be a Republican
facts,
and not be pro-life or pro-choice.
Yeah,
we're the party of intellectual diversity. You're the party of lockstep liberalism.
And with Lewinsky, it's important to remember, different than Watergate, the media wanted Nixon's head. With the media, Newsweek refused to even report on the Lewinsky scandal. They pulled it, and then Newsweek leaked it to a guy named Matt Drudge. If it wasn't for Matt Drudge, the scandal would not have been reported. The media was protecting Clinton all along.
Well, folks in the Newsweek home leaked it to Drudge. It was not Newsweek leaking
That's
it
right.
to Matt Drudge.
Yeah.
Right. Michael Isikoff.
I'm not sure that Michael Isikoff did it. It was somebody.
Know, but again, Mike,
he was the guy who wrote the story, and then
Michael
it got spiked
because
the Democrat media
him.
Was
but
protecting
Mike,
the Democrat president.
Ultimately, it was the Isikoff reporting and the Drudge leak that led to the avalanche of publicity that led to Clinton's.
For whatever reason, the story got pulled.
Again, this started with talking about Watergate. We ended up talking about Clinton. But I want to just take them on. I wasn't going to do this, but I do want to, since it's in the context of what we're talking about, because we're talking about things that happened many, many years ago. Last night, I had the pleasure, and I would say it was one of the most pleasurable, invigorating nights that I've ever spent in the theater. It was the first public reading of a new play called Assassination Theater. It was in Oak Park at the Ernest Hemingway Museum and Hall up there. Hillel Levin is an investigative journalist and a playwright from Chicago. He has written this new piece. You can go online to assassinationtheater.com and look it up. It is a thorough investigation of the Kennedy assassination. And before you just say, oh, my God, Bruce is off on that again, it is four actors reading testimony from the Warren Commission, the House Select Committee, other FBI documents, all official documents being read and weaving a very complex story together. It was a remarkable, remarkable presentation. The ultimate, the people calling the shots, according to this, no pun intended, goes back to organized crime, is how the story is. That's the focal point of the play. But the way in which it is told, it is a play that eventually will come to a downtown theater. Hopefully it will someday be on Broadway and become an important role in the continuing discussion of that, just as the movie JFK started discussions many years ago. Although this is far more fact-based,
right,
because it's based on actual evidence, actual testimony, brilliantly presented.
Right.
And again, I'm not going to give away the end of the play, but it suffice to say that the patterns that were apparent in Dallas,
yeah,
the players, yep, that were apparent in Dallas, the puppeteers that were apparent in Dallas,
yeah,
had experience in doing it at a previous time.
Yeah.
And they had experience,
oh, yeah,
also in pulling it off yet another time in history. Just look at it. It talks about motive. It talks about acoustics. It talks about medical evidence. And it talks about politics, and most importantly, I think it explains at least more clearly to me, and I've been covering this story for many, many years, 40 years plus years, it explains the motivation of Lyndon Johnson, not that he was involved, the Lyndon Johnson role and the Warren and Earl Warren's role and the important role that the Warren Commission played for the sole purpose of diffusing any public discussion and asking of questions whether there was a conspiracy. It was a plan that was put in place. But if you want to hear this story unfold in a very easy to follow, but yet an easy to follow narrative play involving a very complex subject, I call your attention to Assassination Theater, and I hope that everyone listening to this program will someday have the opportunity to experience this remarkable 2.5 hours I spent in the theater last night. I'm Bruce Dumont, back shortly from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much. Let's go to Niles. He's in Michigan. Niles, Michigan. It's Mike. He's in Niles, Michigan.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Niles, Michigan, right on the border of South Bend, Indiana, and Notre Dame country.
Yes, so you're listening to us on 91 point, I forgot.
That's the WLS, actually.
Oh, you're listening on WLS. Right, okay. That's
it
good.
Comes over Lake Michigan.
Good.
Three quick, what's the word we use now? Flashpoints, or you got 3 seconds to get your point across. Yeah. To Mark, three quick questions. Number one, where do you find the word capitalism in the United States Constitution, and it's not the government's job to promote the general welfare of the people? Two, when Washington said two keys to a strong America, keep strong American borders and stay out of other countries' wars and squabbles, we're 139 countries, was he a communist or a socialist, Mr. Republican, Tea Party? Render to God what's God, render to Caesar what's Caesar.
Charlie Kirk. Charlie Kirk is ready for your answer.
What's your third point?
Also,
Is Bush Rick and Perry Cheney said. Off the hook for war crimes?
Who?
They started this whole mess.
Who?
Remember the Billy Joel song, "We Didn't Start the Fire"? Bush and Cheney and Halliburton started the fire.
No, they were born to run. Get it? No.
Go ahead.
Back to your point, was capitalism ever mentioned in the Constitution? I don't know. I'm going to go to kind of pick and choose apart that whole thing. I've never really heard that before, but I think freedom and liberty were a big tenet of the Federalist Papers and protection of private property.
Property and pursuit of happiness.
And also I think the Federalist Papers mentioned something about, you know, the entrepreneur and freedom of commerce and those types of things. So not exactly sure the
commerce
point
was a big deal in the Constitution, the founding of the Republic.
Yeah. Yeah.
Kevin in Cedar Park, Texas. Well,
He makes a point about Washington, which I think is a very important point. Washington was a brilliant leader, and Washington was a once in a millennium kind of person.
George Washington
was a once in a millennium kind of person, and I think it is very hard to extrapolate from the late 18th century into the early 21st century. And I think that there was a hell of a lot of wisdom in what Washington said, but Washington was not acquainted with either the Soviet U.S. struggle or the post World War II realities that led to a bipolar world or the post-Cold War era.
Well, more than
that. I think there's wisdom in what Washington said learn from. But
we got to get Kevin on because he's going to win a long time. Kevin, go ahead. You've been waiting 47 minutes. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Bruce. First of all, I just wanted to say I wish I could hear Tom Roser on the radio. He was a teacher of mine, and I always enjoyed him.
Me
and I
too.
We all miss Tom.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, great guy.
You know that he's he passed away, right?
Yes, I do. That's
okay, very good. Because the way you said it, I wasn't sure whether you knew. Go ahead.
Oh yeah, no, he was a teacher of mine at UIC. Great guy.
He was
a lot of fun.
Regular guest on this program. Original member panel.
Yeah, he was. And then a couple of points. First, why the difference between ISIL and ISIS? That's just a minor thing, but you know, the whole thing in Iraq reminds me of what's the movie Bill Wilson's War, I think it was.
Mm-hmm. Wilson's War?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. Charlie Wilson's War. Why didn't we leave, even if it was we didn't leave military there, why didn't we leave non-governmental institutions to try to build things up? And also, one thing is, I think everybody should see the front line, how we lost Iraq, which kind of defines things. Anyhow, I'd love to hear your guys.
Well, let me, a quick reaction.
Sure.
We have left... There has been a personal friend of mine, Ambassador Joseph Gogossian, was working in Baghdad until 5 weeks ago. And he is an American, and he was accredited to the government, and he was working on issues of municipal administration, and he was doing so under USAID. And Joe Gogossian is a great American and a great patriot with an amazing career. Was only one of many Americans who are still in Baghdad, still working with Iraqis. So I think the whole story and the whole appreciation of everything that we did for Iraq and everything that was handed over to the Obama administration is going to take years to be fully expressed. I think it's very easy to say, oh, we were given a pile of crap. The actual truth is a lot had happened. A lot of good things had happened.
Philip.
And yes, the Obama administration was given a pile of crap, and the point I want to make is I'd like us to take a look at what the implications of the disintegration of Iraq is for Afghanistan when we're out of Afghanistan.
Right.
Because they're a much more tribal-based culture, and I think they have a much greater potential for disintegration into short of civil war, but that's
sort of internal
conflict.
We're going to see the same thing, are we not?
The thing that frightens me most is returning to that sort of post-Russian withdrawal Afghanistan that allowed the Taliban to come back, and that it becomes that training ground again for a more experienced group of foreign fighters that have had a decade or more of experience fighting in Iraq and fighting in Afghanistan, that they decide that that's going to be their number one export product.
Yeah, and I think, and obviously what's happening in Afghanistan, for those who don't know, there's a controversy among the leading contenders to replace Karzai. Abdullah, I believe the former foreign minister of Afghanistan, has not accepted the results of the election that show him losing because he was winning in the previous contest. And so they have to get that sorted out. Once it is sorted out, I expect a status of forces agreement to happen because they're watching what's happening in Iraq, and they're going to say, whoa, 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 we are not going to let this thing go. We want American troops to stay as some form of a stabilizing force. Mm-hmm. I think they're going to learn from the mistake that Maliki made in rejecting a status of forces agreement.
On that note, we are out of time for our guests. David Lundy, thank you very much for being with us. One of our Democrats, Philip Beverly, also one of our Democrats from Chicago State. Charlie Kirk from Turning Point USA, and the ever-popular Chris Roebling, thank you very much for being with us as well. This program is a Genevieve production, produced in association with WLS Talk Radio. Our thanks to Todd Neville and Dan Dorfman for their assistance in the production of this program. Until next week at the same time, this is Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.